So, we're here to talk about Bruce Lee, the most famous Asian American to ever live. I'd like to sort of start off with briefly why he's important, and then who he was, or more specifically, who I see him as, because everybody has their own Bruce Lee. In August 1973, Warner Brothers released in America a little movie that no one had any really high hopes for. Warners hated the title, Enter the Dragon. They thought it sounded either like a horror movie or like a kid's cartoon movie. The budget they gave it had no high hopes for it. It was made for a minuscule $850,000. In comparison, The Exorcist, which was produced that same year, 1973, had a budget of $11 million. So it seemed like it was going to be this cruddy little action movie starring someone no one had ever heard of. So everyone was quite shocked when it broke all box office records, taking in $90 million in the first year, over $400 million since its release. But it was bigger than just the money. It had an incredible cultural impact. Enter the Dragon launched the Kung Fu craze. Soon after Enter the Dragon, Hong Kong movies were playing everywhere. At one point in time, New York City had 30 different, what they began to call chop socky movies, playing in different theaters. That song, Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting, sold 11 million copies. And no one heard of the singer ever again after that, for good reason. And it also inspired people. You know, a lot of movies come out and they do well, but they don't change people's lives. Before Enter the Dragon, there were about 100 martial arts studios across the United States. By the 1990s, there were 20 million martial artists in America. The line the producer, Fred Weintraub, said is that before 1973, every little town in America had a church, a barber shop. After Enter the Dragon, every little town in America had a church, a barber shop, and a karate studio with a poster of Bruce Lee on the wall. So all the strip mall martial arts studios, my son's 3.5, he goes to Taekwondo, he does that because of Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee inspired millions and millions of people through this movie, Enter the Dragon. Another important breakthrough of the movie, Enter the Dragon, is it's the first time Hong Kong and Hollywood ever co-produced a movie. It's hard to imagine now because we're so used to seeing these Hong Kong martial arts and other types of movies playing, but before 1973, no one watched a Hong Kong movie outside of what was called the Mandarin Circuit, the series of theaters that ran from Hong Kong through Indonesia, Taiwan, and into the Chinatowns in the West. If you had a mainstream theater, you just didn't run Hong Kong movies. They didn't show up at the festivals, etc. So this all changes with Enter the Dragon, and it also meant there was a huge influx of money into the Hong Kong movie industry, which also led to a huge influx of criminality, and also talent. So all of this takes off after this. Hong Kong's movie industry at the time was sort of like Nigeria's today, and now it's a kind of world phenomenon equal of sort of Bollywood, one of the three major producers of movies. The other major impact of Enter the Dragon, of course, is that it starred Bruce Lee. This was the first time in Hollywood history that a Chinese-American male actor had ever starred in a Hollywood movie. Up until that point, even parts written specifically Chinese parts were given to white actors. It was called the Yellow-Faced Era. So Fu Manchu, Charlie Chan, there were a series of movies in the 1960s. Those were all played by white actors. Charlie Chan was played by a Swedish actor, so they couldn't even get someone from Southern Europe to play him. Genghis Khan was played by John Wayne in a movie. So this was the era that we're talking about. So Bruce Lee was the Jackie Robinson Chinese actors. He opened the door, and one indication of how hard it was to open the door is that as soon as he left the scene, the door slammed shut again, and it didn't reopen for the next 25 years until Jackie Chan starred in a movie called Rush Hour in 1998. And of course, now we have Crazy Rich Asians, so about every 20 years, Hollywood remembers there are Asians in this country who like to go see movies. And by making this movie, Bruce fundamentally changed the perception of Asian Americans in the country. There was a line where Leon Jay, who was the son of a very famous jiu-jitsu star, said he grew up in Alameda, and that was the center of the Black Panthers. And when he was growing up, he would walk around town, and people would go, "Hey, Chink." And after Enter the Dragon, people go, "Hey, brother," like that. And so Bruce Lee created a new archetype of the Asian male. There was, before Fu Manchu, the Yellow Peril villain, and Charlie Chan, who was the kind of model minority character. Bruce Lee created the Kung Fu Master, and thus created a archetype equivalent to, say, the samurai for the Japanese or the cowboy for America. This idea of this kind of heroic, violent male figure who could take anyone on, who wasn't scared, wasn't frightened, wasn't servile, didn't walk around with his head bent. He had his head up, his shoulders back. He was tough. He had a beautiful musculature. He could kick your ass. That was the image that Bruce Lee created. And, of course, since then, that's the image that's continued to be repeated. So he created his own sort of stereotype. Now, the tragic thing about the release of Enter the Dragon in August 1973 is that Bruce Lee didn't get to enjoy its success. He died a month before its release at the age of 32, in his prime. So, what's interesting to me, having worked on his biography for the last 7 years, is that he's the only major celebrity of the 20th century whose fame was entirely posthumous. Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, even Elvis Presley, they were already famous in the West before they died. They already had a public persona. But Bruce Lee, who was bigger than the Beatles in Hong Kong, was almost unknown in America or anywhere else. So after he died, basically what happened is people had to fill in the gaps, or in fact write the whole story. It was a blank slate because no one really knew anything, and most of the Western authors couldn't read Chinese or speak Chinese, so they couldn't find the sources, the interviews he'd done in China. So they just sort of made up who Bruce Lee was from blank slate. And what they did is they just watched his movie, Enter the Dragon, and then the three previous ones that were quickly released, Big Boss, Fist of Fury, and Way of the Dragon, and they turned Bruce Lee into the character he played on screen, the Kung Fu Master. And they turned him into a legend. And so Bruce Lee quickly became a superhero. And when I watched Enter the Dragon, I thought of him the way my son thinks of Spider-Man. Like he was this heroic, almost comic book character who was invincible, who couldn't stop. And in fact, when I was researching this, I was on some internet forum where there were adults seriously debating whether Bruce Lee could beat the Hulk in a fight. And I thought, well, he's a fictional character, the Hulk, and no, he couldn't. But the point being that Bruce Lee has become this kind of archetype of Achilles. He's the great warrior. Someone says, "I want to be as bad as Bruce Lee." I think Eminem has a song. I wanted to be the Bruce Lee of loose leaf. This idea that Bruce Lee is the sort of par excellence of fighting, and everybody wants to be a version of that. And that's what he became in the cultural image, and that's why he's iconic. But when you write a biography, you actually have to find out who the person is. And so I went back, instead of what people did originally, which was to start with his old movies and go back the last 2 years of his life and then try to fill in the rest, I thought you should start with who he was when he was born. There's a saying for biography, the child is the father of the man. But I realized with Bruce Lee, you had to go even farther back. You had to go back to his ancestry in order to understand who he was. One of the stories that was told for years and years about Bruce Lee was that his great-grandfather was a German Catholic priest who had knocked up a Chinese parishioner and had a daughter who was Bruce Lee's mother. This turned out to be totally untrue. In fact, Bruce Lee's European ancestry dates back to his great-grandfather, Moses Hertog Bozeman. I think the photo pops up here. So Bruce Lee was part Dutch-Jewish. In fact, it was funny. My wife was Jewish, and I ran down, and I was like, "I found one of your tribe members." So Moses Hertog Bozeman was born in Rotterdam to a Jewish butcher. He decided that he was rebellious as a teenager, and he ran off to Hong Kong, where he got into the coolie trade. Now, the coolie trade is interesting. In the 1860s, what had happened is African slavery was slowly being banned across the world. And so capitalists and businessmen were looking for a cheap source of labor, and they found it in southern China, which was suffering great economic and political turmoil and had a lot of peasant workers who were starving. And so unscrupulous businessmen, like Bruce Lee's great-grandfather, promised them riches if they would go work in the Dutch East Indies or mining gold at Sutter's Mill in California after it was discovered. And so in America, there became a great influx of Chinese male low-skilled labor into the West to mine the gold mines, and when the gold ran out, to build the Pacific Railroad. They were guest workers. They weren't allowed to bring their wives because no one wanted them to stay and form families. They expected them all to leave. They didn't. There were more and more immigrants that came, and by the 1880, a quarter of China's male workforce, of its labor force, was Chinese. This caused what was called the yellow peril fears, the idea that America would be overrun by an Asiatic horde, and the white majority would become the minority. And so there became, particularly amongst the white working class, particularly Irish immigrants, there was a big move to ban Chinese workers. And this got pushed up all the way to Congress. And they passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, banning all Chinese laborers from entering the United States. This law was in effect for 60 years. It was the first time America ever banned anybody based on race, religion, or country of origin. And of course, nowadays we have something similar. So you can see that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. At any rate, Moses Hertog, who was not a very nice man, made a fortune in the coolie trade. And what he did was he was a lot of people in colonial Hong Kong, which had just been taken over by the British. He bought himself a Chinese concubine, and with her he had six children. And then he went bankrupt, and instead of sticking around, he ran off to California and abandoned his Chinese wife and his six Eurasian children. His wife was, to protect her children, she became the concubine of a Chinese cattle merchant who sent them to the best school in Hong Kong where they learned English. And so they had a tremendous advantage in British colonial Hong Kong in the fact that they were part European and could speak English. So they could speak to both cultures. And Moses Hertog Bozeman's first son, Sir Robert Hotung, who was Bruce's great uncle, became the richest man in Hong Kong because he could talk to both sides. And he got involved with Jarnead Matheson, which was kind of the Goldman Sachs of Hong Kong, investing in various real estate, opium, trading ships, etc. Sir Robert became so rich he couldn't handle all the business, so he hired his younger brother, Ho Kom Tong, who was Bruce's grandfather, and Ho Kom Tong quickly became the second richest man in Hong Kong. He was so rich that he had a wife, 13 concubines, and a secret British mistress that we don't know anything about. But with her, he had Bruce's mother. So instead of being a quarter German, Bruce Lee is part Dutch Jewish, part English, and part Chinese. Now, why does this matter other than it's kind of curious that we think of Bruce Lee as a Chinese kung fu master? I think it's interesting and important in understanding who he was because growing up in Hong Kong, he was neither nor. And so, therefore, he faced discrimination from both sides. The British thought of him as Chinese and looked down upon him because the British controlled Hong Kong. And then, of course, in America, the same thing happened. But he was also not fully accepted by the Chinese community. There's a famous story where he was studying under Master Ip Man, the style of Wing Chun. Those of you who know Bruce Lee probably know this about Ip Man. But he was annoying the other students because he was getting good very quickly, and he was kind of cocky and competitive, and they wanted to get rid of him. And when they found out he was Eurasian, they said to Ip Man, you can't teach kung fu to Huan Shui, a mixed blood. And so you have to get rid of him. Well, Ip Man didn't get rid of him, but he told him to kind of lay low and go study with Wang Shunlong, who was his senior student, and stay out of the main class for a while. And this led Bruce Lee to have what I would consider a kind of post-racial attitude. When he got to America, his first kung fu student was Jesse Glover, who was an African-American. And at that time in America, the Chinese community and the African-American community were at odds. And even his Chinese bosses at the time said, you can't teach Kung Fu to African-Americans. And Bruce said, I'm going to teach it to whoever I want. And so he quickly had the most diverse Kung Fu class that was ever seen in America because he didn't care about race, and he didn't care about race because he knew what it was like not to be accepted. Once he was asked, do you think of yourself as North American or Chinese? And he responded, I like to think of myself as a human being because under heaven there is only one family. It just so happens that we look different. One of, I think, his most important messages. The second reason why his Eurasian background is important is because, unlike in the movie Dragon, where he's portrayed as being this kind of broke kid who's a Horatio Alger story, who comes to America and makes it, he actually came from a wealthy family. On his mother's side, they were the richest people in Hong Kong. So Bruce Lee had two advantages from that. One is he went to the best parochial schools in Hong Kong, where English was the first language. And so if he had grown up like Jackie Chan did, whose parents were so poor they had to sort of give him away to a Chinese opera company, he never would have made it in Hollywood, because to make it in Hollywood in the 1960s, you had to be able to speak English. And even there, he had problems because he had a slight accent. So his wealthy background enabled him to achieve the success he later had in life. Also, I think importantly, it gave him a sense of pride that allowed him to dream about overcoming obstacles no one else would have considered possible. So when he got to America, he didn't just think he wanted to be an actor, he thought he wanted to be the biggest star on earth. Now, that's pretty absurd. If I thought that, that would be absurd. But for somebody in 1965 from Hong Kong to think that they could be the biggest star on earth takes a great deal of ego. And yeah, you can't have that ego unless when you were a little kid you were felt a little bit better than everyone. And he grew up in a family that had a driver, had servants, had TVs, and this gave him a kind of sense of confidence. Now, the other thing that influenced Bruce was not just his mother's side, but of course his father. His father's family was as poor and powerless as his mother's was rich and important. His father came from one of those peasant families that his great-grandfather had been selling off to America. His grandfather on his father's side was desperately poor. His father grew up with like eight siblings, three of whom died before the age of five. There wasn't enough food to go around. They couldn't afford to go to school. Bruce Lee's father, Lee Hoi Chuen, escaped this because his first job was working as a menu hawker in front of a restaurant in Fujian. And at that time, instead of like having the menus listed on a bill, on a board, they would hire little boys to sing the menu items in a kind of falsetto as people walked past. And Bruce Lee's father apparently was a pretty good singer. And one day a Chinese opera star walked by and heard something special in the 10-year-old boy's voice and invited him to be his apprentice. And that's how Bruce Lee's father became an actor. And he eventually became one of the most famous comic stage actors in Hong Kong. And that's how he met his mother. His mother's uncle, Sir Robert Ho Tong, invited Bruce's father's opera troupe to give a private performance. And at that performance, she saw him sing, she saw he was handsome, and she fell for him. And so, to the great disappointment of her family and the custom of the time, she chased after him and won him over and defied her parents, who didn't want her to marry a broke actor. They expected her to be in an arranged marriage to some rich family. She married him. And together, they had five kids, which is important because in the movie Dragon, again, Bruce Lee has no siblings. He doesn't have a mother. He just has a father. He's basically this kind of, like in all comic book movies, when you create a hero, you have to kill off the parents. They have to be orphans. But Bruce Lee came from a regular family. He was the fourth child. He had an older brother, Peter, and this is important because Peter was the star child. He was the model minority. He was the one Bruce's father favored because Peter was serious, he was studious, he got good grades, he did fencing, he was everybody's, he was the one who was going to go to college, and he ended up getting a PhD in physics and being a very respected man in the community. Bruce Lee is the youngest until his for most of his life, up until he was eight, he was the youngest, was the troublemaker. His nickname was Never Sit Still. If he had been born in our era, they'd have put him on Ritalin before he got out of the crib. He was clearly ADHD or some version of that. He bounced around. He got into trouble. He couldn't focus in school. He got terrible grades. There was always reports on him. He played pranks. He did everything wrong. But the one thing he really, truly loved was acting. Because his father was a stage actor, when the movie industry kicked back in after World War II ended, after World War II ended, Bruce's father became a movie actor, and he would take his son on set. And his son was so energetic, he would run around and climb on all the lights and everything. And the director noticed that kind of energy that Bruce had, which people noticed throughout his life, and offered him a part. So at 6 years old, Bruce Lee began his acting career. This is important because Bruce Lee eventually appeared in 20 Cantonese language films before he was 18 years old. None of these were kung fu movies. In almost all of them, he played a scrappy orphan with a heart of gold. He was kind of the Macaulay Culkin of Hong Kong. And why does that matter? Because it's important to understand that Bruce Lee was not a martial artist who fell into acting later in life. He was an actor, full out, who later became a martial artist and then merged those two passions and became the kung fu movie star icon we think of today. Chronology matters in understanding Bruce Lee's story. So he appeared in a lot of these films, but if you want to understand Bruce, there's an element of the Oedipal conflict he had with his father. Because his father was the star, his father got him into the movies, you can read Bruce's life as an attempt to outdo his father. And it started from a very early age, because Bruce got in his first movie, he had a small part, and his father had a big part. By the time he was 10, Bruce had the leading role, and his father had a small part in the movie called Assam, The Kid, also known as, in 1950. And after that movie, it was a huge success. They wanted to make a sequel, and Bruce's father said no. His son couldn't do that. Now, his explanation was his son was getting bad grades and doing poorly in school, and so he wasn't going to allow him to mess up in school and continue his acting career. So this was he essentially got an acting timeout. But this derailed Bruce's young career, and he didn't get another leading role until he was 18 years old. And there's some sense that perhaps he was a bit resentful to his father because of that. He certainly was resentful of another thing, which is that his father was an opium addict. Most Cantonese opera stars at that time smoked opium. During Bruce's early life, it was kind of a casual thing. But by the time Bruce was a teenager, it's very clear that his father had slipped into deep addiction and was no longer sort of present for his family. And Bruce later complained to his wife and friends about what it was like to grow up with a father who wasn't there for him. There was the exceedingly complicated relationship every man has with his father was even more complicated in Bruce's case. And I think that if you want to understand his life, you have to understand that he was an actor from an acting family, from an entertainment background, who was in a way trying to recreate what his father had done in an even grander scale. Now, we often think of Bruce Lee the martial artist, and that, of course, is crucial. He was a great martial artist, one of the best to ever live. His career started when he was 16 years old. He signed up to study with Ip Man, the style of Wing Chun. The reason he started was not because he was this little scrawny bullied kid. The reason he started is because he was a terror in school, and he would go out with his friends and get into fights on the street. So he didn't start martial arts for self-defense, it was for self-offense. He wanted to be a better fighter. And he met a kid named William Chung, who was a better fighter than he was. And Bruce Lee hated not being the best fighter. And so he tried to figure out why William Chung was better than him, because he didn't like the fact that in the hierarchy, he had to kind of kowtow to William Chung. And William Chung was a better fighter because he studied Wing Chun under Ip Man. So Bruce Lee said, introduce me to your master. I want to learn. And he went to his first class, and he said to the master, how long before I can be better than William Chung? And by the way, how long before I'm better than you? And Wong Chun Lung was his teacher, and he said, this great phrase, he said, Bruce Lee, he asked too much. So Bruce Lee very quickly became really good. He was obsessed with it. I'm sure everybody knows, if you have martial artist friends, you know that kid who, or that guy who's like every day he's like punching and doing, you know, blocks and whatever. That was Bruce Lee on this, walking down the street. He was kicking, he was jumping, he was trying to do, when he put on his clothes, he was like doing a balancing act. He was obsessed with the martial arts. He was so obsessed that he continued his research into the martial arts on the streets. He would go out and wear flamboyant clothing. It was a West. He would wear a traditional Chinese garb in Hong Kong, which where most people were wearing Western suits. And he would wait for somebody to look at him or say something, and then he would go, "You got something to say to me?" And then he would start a fight in order to do his kung fu. Now he did this so often that, and it's important to understand that Hong Kong is today is like a banking slash shopping mall, high end shopping mall. In 1950s, Hong Kong was basically this fisherman's town slash refugee camp. It was desperately poor. After China's revolution, there were millions and millions of refugees who had flooded into Hong Kong. And so there was a great deal of criminality and poverty and depression and fights on the street. So the idea that you would see little kids getting fights on the street in Hong Kong now is absurd, but then it happened all the time. So the reason why that's important is the police let this go for a while because they had bigger things to worry about than some movie actor's son getting into fights on the street. But eventually he got into so many that the police went to his mother and said, "Look, we've let this go, but if this continues, we're going to have to throw him in jail." His mother panicked. Bruce was 18 at the time. He'd already been expelled from one school. He wasn't going to graduate from another. His movie career seemed to be on the skids, so he didn't have any obvious way he was going to make a living, and they were extremely worried about him. So they said, "Bruce, you have one thing going for you. You were born in America. You have an American passport. You can leave and go to America. And maybe you should, because things aren't going well for you here, and it looks like if you continue here, you're going to end up in jail or worse." So they picked him up and shipped him off to America. He ended up in Seattle at Ruby Chow's restaurant. He ended up there because the owner, Ruby Chow's husband, Ping Chow, had been an old Chinese opera acting buddy of his father. So Bruce Lee showed up thinking that he would be treated like an honored guest, the son of the owner's old friend. His father was so mad at him that he called up Ping Chow, Ruby's husband, and said, "Teach him what the real world's like." So they stuck him in a closet under a staircase. They called a room. It was about that wide and that long. And they gave him the crappiest jobs in the restaurant, bussing tables, cleaning the floors. He was a scullion. And since he had grown up with servants, the idea that he was now the servant drove Bruce crazy. He hated it. He complained all the time. He said he was an exploited worker. He called Ruby Chow the dragon lady. She hated his guts. Until the day she died, she hated his guts. But in that conflict, Bruce was actually scared straight. He realized this is what his life would be if he didn't straighten up. And he got turned around really quick, amazing enough. He went to high school, technical high school, in order to get his degree. Then he went to the University of Washington. He started his major in drama, but became very interested in philosophy, but his big thing was he had opened a kung fu school, and he believed at that time that he could become the Ray Kroc of kung fu, which is franchise kung fu schools like McDonald's across the country. And the reason was is because Japanese karate had just recently started to become a kind of hip thing in America. Elvis was a black belt in karate, and on stage he would do like his karate kicks, and a lot of Hollywood people were getting into karate. And Bruce, as a very proud Chinese, knew, as all Chinese martial artists know, that Japanese karate is inferior. I'm kidding. But that's what they believe. They believe it's a derivative style, that martial arts were originated in China and the Japanese took it and made an inferior form. And so Bruce said, "Why should you study this inferior thing? I'm here. I'm going to bring you the real stuff." And so he opened up a school in Seattle And his idea was, after college, he was going to open up schools all across the country. And he would be this successful businessman, tycoon slash cultural envoy to America. He also fell in love with a young blonde co-ed by the name of Linda Emery. And they inadvertently got pregnant. So he had to drop out of school and start his career earlier than he was planning. So, unfortunately, he realized that starting kung fu schools when you're a 23-year-old college dropout with a kid on the way is a tough business. And he opened one in Oakland that didn't do so well, and this one in Seattle. He was having trouble keeping going. But the thing Bruce tried to do to get more students, because he was an actor, was to give, to give demonstrations all across the country, all across sort of where whoever would have him along the West Coast. So if Seattle had a, you know, a fair, if there was a Chinese New Year's festival, he and his students would go give performances. And Bruce, who was an actor at heart, was really good at this. And so, like his father before him, he got on stage and gave these performances where I think of it almost like a stand-up comic honing his act. Bruce Lee became Bruce Lee Kung Fu Master, in which he showed what he could do on stage. And by giving performances in little places across the country, he also got to see what worked, what the audience react to, what techniques made them like, woo, and what techniques kind of made them lean back and fall asleep. So he was learning how to become a martial arts performer, even as he was thinking of himself exclusively as a martial arts instructor. And what happened was, in Los Angeles, Long Beach, in 1964, at an international karate tournament, he gave a performance that got people's tongues wagging. And eventually, a Hollywood TV producer who had this radical idea of having an American TV show about an Asian character starring an Asian actor heard about him, because he was looking for somebody to play an action role in a TV series which he called Charlie Chan's Number One Son. This was the program that William Dozier, the producer, wanted to make. He asked around who could play, who could be charismatic, who could do action. And the person he had asked had seen Bruce Lee at this tournament and said, "You got to talk to Bruce Lee." So Dozier called him up. Bruce Lee heard that Hollywood was interested. Bruce Lee looked at his balance sheet and his bank account, and he said, "I'm going to Hollywood." So he went there, and he thought he was going to be the star of a TV series, which would have been the first time an Asian American male actor had ever starred in a TV series in America. And then he quickly found out that Hollywood is a tough place to work, because that show never got off the ground. Instead, he was given the role of a houseboy and the sidekick, Kato, to the Green Hornet. So he got demoted before his career even started. Now, Bruce Lee didn't like it, but he didn't have any money, so he didn't have any way to argue with it. But he also, the producer promised that Bruce could show off his kung fu. And so the Green Hornet was the first time an American audience had actually seen a real kung fu master do kung fu on TV. And it was a breakthrough for the very small martial arts community of the time. And it was also a breakthrough for many sort of minority communities had never seen someone who wasn't white being the sort of badass on TV. And so, you know, I was talking to someone from the Wu-Tang Clan on some interview, and he was like, "Yeah, we were down with Bruce Lee back when he was Kato." And I was like, "Okay, cool." So that's how Bruce Lee's career got started. And as soon as it got started, it almost ended. The TV show, aside from Bruce Lee, wasn't very good, and it got canceled within one season. And after that, he became an unemployed actor, trying to find parts in Hollywood that didn't have any parts for an Asian actor, that wasn't houseboy or servant or bad guy in a World War II movie. And Bruce Lee refused to wear a pigtail, which meant he couldn't be in any of the Westerns. So for the next 4 years, he got like one part a year in a kind of guest starring role, which wasn't enough to keep him alive. So the way he survived was he recreated himself to become the Sifu to the stars. He became the personal martial arts instructor to the top people in Hollywood. His students included Steve McQueen, James Coburn, and the Academy Award-winning screenwriter Sterling Siliphant, amongst many others. So he got to be... Bruce, who was very clever, realized that this was a way to make a lot of money because he was charging these guys like $800 an hour for a lesson, which would be good money even today. But he also knew that if he hung out with them, they were the kind of people who could vouch for him within the industry. So he was coaching Steve and James at the same time he was pitching them his own projects. He'd be like, Steve, let's do this silent flute project. You'd be great in it. And that was his idea of how he was going to make it, because he knew no Hollywood studio would ever give him a major role in a movie. So he was trying to work it from behind the scenes. After 4 years of frustration, he started to feel like he wasn't ever going to make it. And at about this point, I'm massaging the story a little bit, but about this point he was offered a two-picture deal back in Hong Kong by Golden Harvest Studios, which was run by Raymond Chow. Golden Harvest Studios was a small startup. It had literally no money, and it was going against Shaw Brothers, which was the monopoly studio in East Asia. And so this studio that didn't have any money and hadn't made a decent movie and had just opened up thought maybe Bruce Lee would give them a shot. But they weren't certain about him. So in the first movie that he makes for Golden Harvest called The Big Boss, what you'll notice is there's actually two stars in the movie. It starts with James Tien, who's the actor who was originally the star, and James Tien is killed about a third away in the movie, and then it becomes a Bruce Lee movie, right? Because they weren't sure when they were filming it which one of the actors would do better, and weren't sure if Bruce Lee had the stuff, so they just put them together, and in the middle of filming they went, he looks pretty good on film. Let's kill this guy. So that's how Bruce Lee became a star, and that's why James Tien never liked him afterwards. Now, what happened was that, shockingly, this movie that was made for $100,000 and has really low production values, even by Hong Kong standards, much lower than its rival Shaw Brothers movies of the same era, blew everyone away because no one had ever seen what Bruce Lee was doing. And the reason was that Hong Kong action at the time was this kind of flowery movement, very fluid. So when they threw punches, it kind of had this nice round movement because they were all trained in the kind of Cantonese opera style. And it looked a lot more like dance than it did like fighting. Now, Bruce Lee was a street fighter. He knew what it was like to punch somebody in the face and get punched in the face. And so, and he'd also trained in Hollywood, which used a lot less movement and motion. So he wanted to do... one punch, I knock that guy out. One kick, I knock that guy out. That was his goal. And they hadn't seen that in Hong Kong before. And it created this sensation so that The Big Boss became the biggest box office hit in Hong Kong history. And Bruce Lee became an overnight sensation. And he would call up his friends back in America and say, Little Joe, I'm bigger than the fucking Beatles. And then he made his next movie, Fist of Fury, also known as Chinese Connection in America. And this movie was this very nationalistic, one of the very first movies in Hong Kong that took on this very overt nationalism, the Chinese versus the Japanese, and we're better than you, and we're not the sick men of Asia, and I'm going to show that to you because I'm going to show you. Listen to me. I will say this only once. We are not the sick men of Asia. So, and then I'm going to beat up 50 judo guys. So Bruce Lee made that movie, and it came at just the right moment. So I'm sure some of you heard about the dispute in the South China Sea over the Senkaku/Diu Islands. This started in 1971 when the U.S. that controlled the islands gave them to Japan. And Hong Kong and Taiwan and mainland China flipped out. And Hong Kong at that time, everybody was furious about the Senkaku-Diu Islands dispute. And so a movie like Fist of Fury hit exactly the right moment because it played on this inherent sense of being oppressed and being looked down upon and always being screwed over. So that movie did even better than The Big Boss. And the movie after that that Bruce Lee wrote and directed, Way of the Dragon, did even better than those three, the two previous ones. And so Bruce Lee had the phenomenon of making one movie after another that did better. No one does this in movies. Everybody does one or two, and then they have a flaw. Bruce Lee did three in a row, And that's when Hollywood came calling, because as the old joke goes, the only color Hollywood sees is green. And they saw that Bruce Lee was making so much money in East Asia that they could leverage that to make a kind of low-budget film that sold. They would sell the rights in East Asia to cover their costs, and if it was slightly better than, you know, the average Hong Kong movie, they could make a ton of money in the West with it. That was the hope. And that's how Enter the Dragon came about, which brings our story sort of full circle. A couple things I want to close on, because everyone asked me about this. How did Bruce Lee die? This is, I joke, if we knew the answer to that, it would have only taken 4 years to write this book instead of seven. Bruce Lee, the important facts to understand in Bruce Lee's death are that about 5 to 6 months before he died, he went to the doctor complaining of excessive sweating, especially in his armpits. And the reason he complained was because he was on screen shirtless in tropical Hong Kong doing scenes, and after every scene they had to wipe him down. And it annoyed him. And the doctors apparently at that time thought it was okay to offer a cosmetic surgery in which you remove the sweat glands from someone's armpits, which he had, that operation, in November 1972. So, 5 months later, May 10th, 1973, I think I have that date right, he's dubbing lines from Enter the Dragon. It's the hottest day of the month in Hong Kong. He goes into this very small dubbing room. And dubbing is where you redo the lines, because sometimes when they're filming, they don't catch the volume right. And so they're in this room, and they have to turn off the air conditioning because that will ruin the soundtrack of them redubbing the lines. The room quickly becomes about as hot as a sauna. Bruce begins to feel dizzy and weak and collapses, throws up, goes into seizures. They run him to the hospital. The doctors diagnose him with cerebral edema, which means swelling of the brain. They gave him a drug, mannitol, to reduce the swelling. They save his life just in time. The doctors, however, suspect that he might have had the cerebral edema because right before he went to the dubbing room, he had had a little hash. And in 1973 in Hong Kong, they didn't know what marijuana really was. It was just this hippie Western drug, and they really had no idea. They knew what opium was. They knew what heroin was, but they didn't understand marijuana. So they thought maybe the hash is what caused it. Flash forward to the day he dies, July 20th, 1973. He has a little hash. He goes over to his mistress, Betty Ting Pei's apartment. They have a little fun. Then later in the afternoon, his boss, Raymond Chow from Golden Harvest, his producer, co-business partner, comes over to pick the two of them up to go out to dinner. Bruce is planning his next movie. Enter the Dragon has finished. It's about to be released. He wants to start with Game of Death. And he's super excited about the movie. And this is why you go spend years and years doing this project, because in trying to interview everyone. When I interviewed Raymond Chow, he said something to me that at the time didn't make much sense until I was later on. He said, you know, Bruce was doing all the moves from Game of Death. He just jumped up and started showing all the scenes and doing all the techniques. And after a while, he started to feel a little dizzy, a little faint, complained of a headache, felt thirsty. Betty Ting Pei gave him an aspirin. He said, my head's really hurting. He went to lie down. Raymond Chow left early, expecting them to come. But Bruce Lee never woke up and died in Betty Ting Pei's bed. And so why I think Bruce Lee died was from heat stroke. I think because he had had the sweat glands removed, and also because he was having trouble sleeping, and these were extremely hot days, and he was overexerting himself, he ended up overheating, and his body couldn't take it. Cerebral edema is one of the things that happens to people who die from heat stroke. It's seen in the autopsies. And so, in a way, he paid the ultimate price for his ambition, and his ambition was to be the greatest star in the world. To be bigger than Steve McQueen, and he couldn't give up. He couldn't take a break. He couldn't quit. He couldn't take a vacation. And so by pushing that hard, he pushed himself to the limit, and fate stepped in and something happened. But I do think that more important than how he died is how he lived. He was a man who believed that we were all equal and that we all could achieve greatness, and he did himself. And so I often think, you know, people say you can do whatever you want to, you can be whatever you want to be. Of course, that's not true. But some cases it is. And Bruce Lee wanted to be the greatest Chinese Asian American star in the world, and that's what he became. And that's why we're all here today. So